We have a cameraman, Wilton, in the back, who's a volunteer here. He came in and he said, "Do you want the panel recorded?" And I said right away, "Is that Wilton?" And he said, "Oh, sure." And my friend Paul said, "Ah!"
My first time presenting, and certainly presenting on this topic, so.
What's your name?
Okay. My name is Paula Pace, and I will be talking about the TPP.
My name is Don Butterfield, and I'm going to talk about rigged trade as opposed to free trade.
And I'm Sue Peters, and I'm going to be talking about the effect of our current banking system in this country on corporations, globalization, the free trade treaty, the effect that the banking system and our monetary system has on corporations and these issues.
Okay.
Paula's going to start.
Oh. So I've actually been aware of trade treaties back from before NAFTA. I've been involved, and really the devastating effect on workers. I've been part of an organization called Local Futures, where the head of the organization, Helena Norberg Hodge, has been talking about corporations and globalization and tying it into the trade treaties. What I only recently became aware of, and maybe all of you have known this for a long time, was what I consider to be the absolutely startling fact that corporations under these trade treaties can sue sovereign governments. And the absolute power of corporations to shape and to benefit from these trade treaties. And what I've seen is that people I've spoken to about the TPP don't seem to know anything about it. Even though on the upside, Elizabeth Warren has absolutely put it onto the front page, and yet people don't seem to know what it's about. I actually understand that, because I think it took me a while to really take it in, even though I was part of an organization where they were talking about it. It's terrifying. It's overwhelming. We can feel totally hopeless about our ability to do anything about it. And it's also abstract. It's very complicated. Last week I heard a journalist on NPR saying, "I can't talk about the trade treaties because I'm not a trade expert." So now it's been relegated to the experts. And the proponents of the trade treaty have managed to couch it as a for and against free trade, when in fact it's not. It's not for two reasons. I mean, it's not about free trade. So that if you oppose the treaty, it doesn't mean you are anti-free trade. In fact, there are people who do support free trade who don't support the treaty. Paul Krugman is an example. So I've been thinking about how do we talk about this issue to really reach people who are disconnected from it and don't really connect because of that abstract aspect of it. And in coming on to this panel, that was my idea, was to how do we bring this down so people can really get it and feel it. And I think of all of us as messengers out from here to talk about it, because this is the time where there's a possibility of stopping it. As you probably know, Fast Track, which is the mechanism for getting it past Congress, has been upheld in the Senate, but has not yet been voted on in the House. And there's a real question as to whether they can get enough votes to vote on it in the House. So this is, and this is going to come up in probably in the next few weeks. So this is really the time when we can make a difference. So the thing, the the three things that I kind of distilled as to what I would want to communicate are, first of all, that it's not the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, is not about free trade. It's about corporate rules and regulations that benefit the corporations. Secondly, corporations can sue sovereign governments, and they can sue them on the basis of they're not, on the basis of expected future profits being, having a loss in expected future profits. That's a basis that they can, in fact, attack all of our domestic laws. And what that means is that corporation profits trump our domestic laws. So our laws that protect the environment, our laws that protect labor, our laws of health and safety are all potentially up for grabs because of the corporate ability to sue for not having sufficient profits in the future. And these are future profits. And thirdly, and this is really important, that we can do something about it. I mean, this is a time when we really can do something. If we can stop fast track in the House, we potentially stop the entire treaty, because if Obama doesn't get fast track, and I'll talk about that more specifically, if Obama doesn't get fast track, then he's not going to get, very unlikely that he will get the treaty passed. So let's go into the details of this. Do you want to? Mm-hmm. So what is the TPP and why is it so secret? So as this is an agreement that is completely secret, and the only reason we know about it is because WikiLeaks has leaked at least four of the chapters. And probably there are some Congress people who have leaked information, but basically it's kept secret. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, called the Free Trade Agreement, and I keep thinking of it as so-called free trade because it's much more than that, is purportedly to regulate trade relations among the U.S. and 11 other Pacific Rim countries. And this agreement actually covers 40% of the global economy. So they say it's a trade agreement, but it's way more. There are 29 chapters, and only five of them are on trade. And as I said earlier, it's an agreement really to promote corporate power. So some of the other areas, which I'm not going to specifically go into, covered are intellectual property, copyright and patents, environmental policy, financial services, procurement, investment. I'm going to talk a lot about the investment chapter because that's the key and that's the mechanism where corporations can actually sue governments. Internet access, medications, labor rights, banking regulations, farm policy. So there's a huge number of areas that are covered by the trade agreement that aren't really about trade. They're really about all these regulations, and they are all couched in favor of the corporations. In terms of the intellectual property, they're giving patents to Big Pharma. They've actually extended their patents, so created more of a monopoly, and really what that's doing is wiping out generic drugs. And Doctors Without Borders has taken a big stand on that. Do we have Doctors Without Borders in our? Anyway, it's something for you to look at. Okay, next one. So, as I said, the TPP is negotiated in secret by the U.S. Trade Representative, which is part of the Office of the President. The U.S. Trade Representative is Michael Froman, and he is actually from Citibank. So we know presumably what his interests are. And he is assisted by about 500 mostly corporate lobbyists who act as advisors, and they get security clearance, and they're allowed to see the text of the agreement. So even though this is completely secret, all these corporate advisors have access to the agreement, which means that they are in a position to control what goes into the agreement. Some members of Congress have viewed the text, but they have to go into a secure room, leave their cell phones out, and they are not allowed to take notes, and they're not allowed to communicate what they've seen. Did you want to say something?
Go democracy.
Yes, go, exactly, go democracy. It gets worse. You go to the next one. So before Congress passed the North Atlantic Free Trade Agreement in 1994, trade agreements were really only focusing on tariffs and quotas. I mean, they were in fact trade agreements. Starting with NAFTA and the so-called free trade agreements, they've now covered all these other areas that we mentioned before: internet access, intellectual property, environment. And I wanted to mention in the environmental chapter, because that's another one that was leaked by WikiLeaks. Public Citizen, Laurie Wallach at Public Citizen, has spoken about that, and it basically doesn't have any teeth. It doesn't have any enforcement ability. So even if Obama says we have this great new policy, there's no means for enforcing it. It was described by Laurie Wallach as being essentially Bush-era standards, and that is the same with labor. Now, since 1994, there have been these multiple free trade agreements, and most of them have included this clause called ISDS, the Investor-State Dispute Settlement Provision. And next one. And that is a provision that basically elevates corporations to the status of a state. It allows foreign corporations to sue sovereign governments and win huge monetary awards based on, as I said, the loss of expected future profits due to domestic laws that all of our domestic laws are in question. All of our protective legislation is basically in jeopardy.
That's Chapter 11 of NAFTA, sort of like the same thing, isn't it?
Excuse me?
Chapter 11 of NAFTA?
Yes.
Would be the same
yes,
thing.
Because all of these agreements have had these ISDS clauses, and the TPP also has this clause. In fact, Elizabeth Warren tried to get an amendment when it came up for fast track to get the ISDS clause out of it. But it's in there at this point.
Isn't it also not just governments, but individuals and organizations?
No, it's governments.
It's that, just governments?
Just governments. Oh, okay. So let's say California has a law that, and in fact there was a case like this, has a law where there was a additive to gasoline that was ruining their water supply, and they put a ban on it. What would happen is that the company would sue the U.S. So U.S. would be, the federal government would be defending it, and California would not even have a seat at the table.
But I thought that also, like, organizations, like environmental organizations, could get sued for trying to stop a corporation from doing this.
They could be, but not under this.
Oh, it's a different thing?
Yeah,
that would be
in a different situation. Problem. So the next one. So the known ISDA cases have increased dramatically. In 2014, there were 600 known cases, and I say known because since they're secret, we don't actually know all of the cases that there might be. So next one. So what I wanted to do was to give you some actual examples so that you can get a sense of really how pervasive this can be and how many of our protective laws really can be called into question. So the first one. All right, so the highest reward so far is $3.2 billion given to Occidental Oil Company. Occidental sued Ecuador over Ecuador's termination of an oil concession contract, even though that termination was apparently legal. And there's little Ecuador having to pay, and when they have to pay, who gets to pay this? The taxpayers do. There's also another case against Ecuador. This one was finished, and that's a case that Chevron brought against Ecuador. And what happened was Chevron, or I think it was formerly Texaco, was polluting the Ecuadorian Amazon and causing huge cancer and other kinds of illness to indigenous populations. And they won in the Ecuadorian court. So then Chevron went to the ISDS and got an injunction against an Ecuadorian court's decision to give Ecuador, I think the amount was $9 billion. And that case is still pending. Okay. So under NAFTA, and all these cases took place under other trade agreements. It's just we know about it and from these other situations, and we can apply it to the TPP, because of course TPP hasn't been passed yet. Under NAFTA, Ethyl Corporation sought $251 million from Canada because Canada implemented a ban on the import and transport of a toxic gasoline additive, MMT. Canada ended up settling with Ethyl, and the terms of it, they paid $13 million, but they also revoked the ban, and they had to advertise that MMT was safe. Okay, I know, it's incredible. And so nuclear, in 2012, Vattenfall, a Swedish utility operating two nuclear plants in Germany, sued the German federal government after Germany decided to shut down the their nuclear industry following Fukushima.
Is this in your handouts? The information?
You know what? If you want it, I can send you the PowerPoint. I'm happy to do that.
That'd be great.
Okay. Yes, you can let me know afterwards.
Did everybody sign? Yeah. If you sign and put your email address, we can email the PowerPoint.
And just put if you want it sent to you, because I'm happy to do that. Okay. Going to the next one. Fracking. A U.S. mining company, Lone Pine Resources, sued Canada because the province of Quebec put a moratorium on fracking due to environmental concerns. So you see, absolutely everything that we hold dear can be challenged by corporations based on their need for profit and on their right for profit. Okay, next one. Health and safety. Philip Morris is suing Australia and Uruguay for their smoking laws that require health warnings on cigarettes. Yes.
Would you prefer questions actually at the end? I can ask it later.
Yeah. Why don't we wait till the end and ask questions?
Yes. You know, if you have a question, write it down so you don't forget it, because we really do want the questions. Yeah.
All right. Next one. Pacific Rim Mining Corporation, this is an interesting one, sued El Salvador under CAFTA, which is the Central American Free Trade Agreement, because they wanted to establish a gold mine in El Salvador's largest river, and El Salvador said no for environmental reasons. Since Canada is not a party to CAFTA, and this gives you an idea of how manipulative they can be, they moved their subsidiary from the Cayman Islands to Nevada in order to establish a U.S. residence. They actually lost on that. They weren't able to establish enough roots in the U.S. I mean, they had an office with nobody in it. But they were then able to sue under an investment law in El Salvador. So that case is still going on. Okay. Minimum wage. French multinational suing Egypt, contesting Egypt's minimum wage, because they raised their minimum wage, and of course that's going to cut down on the corporation's profits. Next one. So, how does the ISDS operate? It's a panel of three judges. The judges are generally corporate attorneys. They've often represented corporations and then moved to become judges. So they move back and forth between representing and being judges. The proceedings are secret. There is no appeal. It's an arbitration, so there's absolutely no appeal. And the only thing the judges are supposed to consider are expected future profits. They aren't supposed to consider environment issues, labor standards, health and safety. They're only supposed to consider profits. Next one. So when Bush, Clinton, Obama talk about these trade agreements, they talk about all the new jobs that are going to happen because of the trade agreements. And the result is exactly the opposite. Not only have we lost jobs, but wages have been depressed. Public Citizen estimates that we've lost since NAFTA 5 million jobs in manufacturing. And what happens is that these trade agreements create a favorable environment for corporations to offshore, so that all our, as we all know, all our business and manufacturing is moving to other countries. And I think the corporations will be exceedingly happy with this TPP, because Vietnam is one of the countries in it, and Vietnam has lower wages than China does. Yeah. So I want to move from the agreement to fast track. Now, as I said, the agreement is still under negotiation. Fast track is the mechanism by which the agreement is gotten through Congress. Excuse my English. It was first actually proposed under Nixon. It gives authority to the president for 6 years to negotiate and sign a trade deal. So that means if he gets fast track, all the trade deals that are negotiated in the next 6 years will be under fast track. Once the president signs the agreement and brings it to Congress, they can only vote it up or down. There's no ability to amend it. And once Congress authorizes fast track, they can't change the treaty. So even if they find that there's some problem with it, they can't change it. We are stuck with it. And what is particularly scary is that presidents after Obama will have that fast track authority going forward. So right now, as I said earlier, that issue of fast track will be going to the House of Representatives if they can get enough votes. I mean, they're not going to bring it to the floor if they don't have enough votes. So this is the time. I mean, the next 3 weeks, if we stop fast track, it's very unlikely that the agreement will survive, because other negotiating parties certainly don't want Congress meddling with it after they've negotiated an agreement. Furthermore, if it does go to Congress, we know how Congress is functioning, it would be very unlikely for them to get it through and pass it. What we have is a handout, and I just want to mention Trade Justice New York Metro. They have a lot of form letters on their website. If you've got
copies of some of them here.
What?
I have some of them printed here.
Oh, you do. Are you at it?
Yes.
Oh, great. Okay. Yeah, all right. So, do you want to speak to that? Because I think it's really important.
The letters.
Yeah. Just that you have that and it's available.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of different form letters that highlight different aspects of the agreements and what their harms are aimed at different audiences. So, for example, we have one on how the agreements will adversely impact access to medicines, one on how they'll promote fracking, one on how they'll undermine efforts to curb climate change, one on industrial farming, one on labor rights, one on how trade, the relationship between free trade and forced migration, one on the impact on the internet, lots of different, we have probably over a dozen different versions for different audiences, and most of those are on our website at tradejustice.net if you click the publications link, along with flyers and other materials. And I mean, the idea is that they can be used for different events. So, for example, at a Earth Day event, we might use the climate literature, or at an AIDS walk, we'd use the literature around impact on access to medicines, or a Labor Day parade, we'd use the one on impact on jobs. And so, I mean, it really is a way of being able to reach the wide range of constituencies that are really under attack by these trade agreements. And also, if I can mention, January 3rd. Is a national call-in day against Fast Track, and so there's, I hope I have enough for the room here, not until I get more. June 3rd, as in this Wednesday, is a national call-in day against Fast Track. So this flyer here will tell you how to contact your elected officials and how to find who they are and how to contact them and some talking points you can use. And if those don't make it all the way around, let me know. We have a table outside. I can probably go snag some more. And I'll pass some of these forms out to people like. Is that okay if I pass these on?
Oh, definitely.
Great.
So I'm going to turn it over to Sue. I think maybe we should. Should we take all questions at the end? Maybe we
no,
should all.
I think that you need to have them separated.
You want it?
Yeah.
Okay.
There's different areas that each one will be covering.
No, they're all related.
They're all related.
I just want to say something strongly because I've we want to get through the presentation because once you start asking questions, it takes time. You have to listen and respond. So just write your questions down, please, so you don't forget them.
Okay. And so welcome, everybody. My name is Sue Peters, and I'm going to talk to you about something that is very, very misunderstood by the public. And is actually not taught in our colleges and in our high schools. And it's not taught because the people who control the corporations, unfortunately, over the course of the last 100 and some odd years, have slowly started to control what we learn in our schools. So you have to come to places like this to hear it, and even a lot of places like this don't talk about it. But I discovered this because I was working for a bank, and I'm a very curious person, and I was learning all about this and that, and I was involved in things outside. And then one day I saw a documentary, and this is what was on the documentary, the core of this. And I said, "No way!" I couldn't believe it, and I studied it. I'm the type of person. I just studied. It took me a long time because all of us have no validation for this in our experience in this country growing up, because they don't want us to know it. So if, you'll see there's a few slides from members of Parliament, because I don't want you to think you can just believe me. They'll be talking about it, and I can have books that will talk about it. Okay? So, and this is important because the monetary system, which is where our money comes from. We all need money. All right? We can't have an economy unless we can buy goods and services, pay our rent, send our kids to college, all that stuff. So there's this thing called money that all of us work for, that we worry about, that we put aside if we're lucky, or we have to pay to the bank for loans, for mortgages, for student loans, whatever. It's there all the time. And I'm going to tell you the truth of how this money came into our society and is functioning. Because the functioning affects things like the TPP and the power of those corporations to affect that, to push it through our government. And the last thing before I start, I'm going to say is
over the course of the last 300 years, when this system developed, it developed in 1694 in the Bank of England being created. It's a private bank owned by financiers. And the first thing they did when they got that charter from Parliament for their money system was they created money and they went into Parliament and they bribed those people in Parliament. Because the government is the only power in our society that can take the power away from private banks. So they turn all of us against the government. Our government, there's a lot bought out, but we need our government. We got to take it back. That's the other thing I just want to say. Okay? So, fossil fuels and our debt-based financial system. See, the word debt is going to show up practically on every slide. Okay? To whom is everyone in debt? I don't know. Anybody here have a mortgage? Mortgages? Yeah. So you're in debt, right?
Yeah.
Student loans? Student loans? You're in debt. Credit cards? You're in debt. We're all in debt. Our government is in debt. Our national government. Okay? Next.
Uh-oh.
You have to do that.
I have to do that. I'm doing this.
Oh, okay.
You need to look at it.
Okay, so first thing I'm going to talk about is public debt. You know how we're all austerity, because there's so much debt, right? We don't have money to pay for infrastructure, for education, for health. Okay, next.
Oops, wrong way.
Okay. Our federal public debt, right, is now a total of 102% of our gross national product. So all the exchanges that happened in this country in 1 year, the value of them, that's how much our federal government is in debt. Next. Every country in the world is in debt. If you look at percentage of their gross national product, Canada is more in debt than us, if you look at it that way. Japan is 226% of their yearly gross. Every country, now think of it, every country in the world has debt. Okay, next. You hear the debt crisis in Europe, all the European countries, Greece, Italy, Portugal, debt. It's endemic in the system that we have. This system is now worldwide, this system, and it's called a debt money system. I'm going to show you why. But keep in mind, every country is in debt around the world. Next. If all the nations of the world are in debt, who are they in debt to? I mean, I have to ask that question, hopefully, you know, like, who are they in debt to? Who are the creditors? Next. Let's look at private debt. In addition to mounting national debts, there are escalating private debts. Next. Student debt. Escalating. Next. Credit card debt. We all walk around with our credit cards. We have to pay for them. Next. Home loans, home borrowers. If you have a mortgage, you're in debt. Next. And even our businesses are in debt. And you can't see this because of the technical difficulty. But this is a boardroom, and this is one of the board members, and he has a parachute on. And he's saying, I have complete confidence that the company will overcome its debt problem. And he's bailing out. Everybody is in debt. Next. Even the chickens are in debt. So if so many individual students, mortgagers, businesses are in debt, who are they in debt to? Next. How big are our debts? Next. mortgage debt, $13.4 trillion. Trillion. Next. Oh. Did we skip some slides?
Yeah.
Huh. Oh, okay. I'll just say our government is $18 trillion in debt. Okay, mortgages, like you say, $13 trillion. Of businesses, non-financial businesses, $5 trillion in debt in this country. Right? Trillions. We're talking trillions now. Next. Who has the wealth? Who has the wealth? If everybody's in debt. The owners of private banking system are far wealthier than anyone else. I'm talking about private commercial banks. That's what I'm talking about. You can see Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, they're a commercial bank. All those names that we bailed out are the big commercial banks. Commercial banks make loans. That's the definition of a commercial bank. You can go in and you can get a loan from them. You can be a business, corporation, individual, whatever, mortgage. Okay, Lily, let's look at them. Let's look at the banks next. Why and how do they do this? Next. What they own. Okay, let's see. What is a bank, what is the commercial banks in this country own? They own $15.4 trillion in wealth. $15.4 trillion. They have cash and they have loans. You can't see it there. The loans that they have given to the public, the corporation, are around $8.5 trillion. Right? They have securities that they own, right? Around $3
trillion.
And they have another other that they don't disclose. This is all from the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. They have another 1.6 that they just say other, and they don't really tell you what that other is. Okay, next. What they owe, and you can't see it here, but this is a man, and he's taking an eye test. And this is the eye doctor. And this is the chart. And it says, if you can read, it's A, me, a lot, you, all me. Okay, next. And this is what the banks owe with deposits and some borrowings. The borrowings are minor, but mostly the deposits. You put deposits in the bank, right? You expect that to come back to you. So in effect, the private banks owe that to you, right? So if you add it all up, it's 13.7. So there's like $2 to $3 trillion that they're clear. They're just clear, you know. Okay, next. Why is the private banking system so wealthy with these trillions of dollars that they own? Next. Next. You will be surprised. Next. Lies we have been taught and are told every day. So there's going to be five lies. And they're you know, the people who spread these lies don't even know their lies. We don't know because we're not told, and we live our lives, and the textbook says this, and you agree with it. You know, why not? Next. Lie number one, government creates our money. How many people think government creates our money? Anybody? I'm not a man, not there. Okay, next. Here's the truth. The government only creates 3% of our money. And that, next, that's the, next, notes and coins. That's the only thing our federal government creates. And of the creations, they do spend the coins. They get to create them and spend the coins. And so we get, you know, we don't have to raise taxes because they create the coins and they spend them. But that's about it. Next. Number two, banks lend money they have in the bank, right? If I come into a bank and I borrow, I think it's coming from some money that's in their vault. or in a depositor's account, and the depositor said, you can loan my money out, just give me some interest. Isn't that the way I grew up thinking? That's the way it is. Next. Truth. Banks create brand new money. When they make a loan, right, you sign that loan agreement, and they type accounting numbers into your account. Now, this is very hard to grasp, because there's no validation in our culture for it. But when you went in to get your mortgage, and you signed a 30-year mortgage for, say, $300,000, that $300,000 was created by the bank and put into your mortgage account. They gave it to you by just typing it in a computer. It didn't exist before. So suddenly, by doing that, the whole money supply of the country got $300,000 bigger. That's the power of the banks, and it's very legal. They put it in the 1913 Federal Reserve Law.
Which year?
They did, 1913. They didn't explain it to the public at all, but they inserted it into that law. And they've been using it ever since. And that's every loan. Credit card loan, student loan, name it, you name it. This is the way that private, and I'll call them corporations, but they're unique corporations. No other corporation can do what this corporation can do, right? So you always have to keep that in your mind too, right? Next. 97% is checkbook money. Now you might say, oh, but I go to work and I get a paycheck. And I've earned that money. I see it right here in this check and I put it in my account. But your boss somewhere down the line borrowed that money from a commercial bank so he would have money to pay you. So if you tracked back where all the money comes from, 97% of all of our money comes from banks creating it. The term is out of thin air, but it's really out of a legal agreement, and they always get, most of the time, security, collateral. So if you get a mortgage, they really own your home until you pay off that loan, right? So this is the system, legal system. Next, private commercial banks, this is the lie, like the Bank of America, just like any other corporation. I call them, they're unique and abnormal. I like to think of them as abnormal because what they do with this privilege that they got in the law is abnormal. It's not nice what they've done to the world. Next. So if a banking corporation gives loans out and the money therefore is out there to circulate, then our economy has life, right? We have jobs. We can pay down our debts, we can buy things that we need, but if they stop making loans, or they call in loans, they can call in loans too, then our economy shrinks because the money is shrinking, right? Because loans are our money, right? And then we're going to lose jobs, we're not going to be able to pay down our debts, and maybe we lose our house. They're controlling that. The system is controlling it. Okay, next. The government decides who gets money. Next. Banking corporation decides who gets money because they're the ones that say, oh yes, we can have a loan, and no, you can't. So it's in the hands of the private corporation. Next. So if you look around our world, who are they giving money to? Weapons manufacturers, stock speculators, congressional lobbyists, agribusiness, fossil fuel companies, mortgages, multinational corporations. They're deciding to give those loans. It's up to them. Next. Well, it's a reflection. I look out the window and you see this house, you know, big, tall building being built. That's all built. The people who are building it had to go to the banks and get loans. And that money was just created. And that's why we have a lot of, you know, office buildings that were very expensive. They're deciding what gets built. It's they're deciding who gets the loan. Line number five, the problem is multinational corporations. The problem is this system that funds them and gives them the power to do what they do. You always have to follow the money. Where is it coming from? Next. The owners of the private debt money system also are on the boards of directors and own shares in the multinational corporations around the world. All those corporations need loans from banks, they need credit lines from banks in order to function. Okay? So the banks are owners of parts of those corporations. Next. You're probably thinking I am not an expert and I don't know what I'm talking about. Now, what I'm saying is nonsense. Can't work like this. So don't take my word for it. And then we have to do this. This is Michael Meacher in November of 2014. He's a member of Parliament, and they're having a debate about money creation in Parliament. It's the first debate in around 140 years.
Ready?
About this topic.
It is unfortunate, as the Honourable Gentleman referred to, that it is so little understood by the public that money is created every time by the banks that they make loans. In effect, they have a virtual monopoly, something like 97% over domestic credit creation, and it is the banks, therefore, the banks, which determine how money is allocated across the economy.
Okay, we have another slide. The next one.
The next one.
Yeah.
It is a...
Okay.
Okay. And this is Mr. Stephen Baker. He's on the other side of Parliament. He's a Conservative. Michael Meacher.
Well, the process is so simple, the mind is repelled. Whenever a bank makes a loan, it simultaneously creates a matching deposit in the borrower's bank account, thereby creating new money. Many times I've been told that this is ridiculous, even by one employee who's previously worked for the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in the United States.
The next one? Yeah, here's another one from Mr. Stephen Baker.
The explanation is actually taken from the Bank of England article, Money Creation in the Modern Economy. It seems to me rather hard to dismiss.
So you don't have to take my word for it. And now, on the handouts at the end, there's links. You can listen to the whole debate. It's around 2 hours long. And there's other links to other organizations that are saying the same thing. Again, keep in mind, the banking system does not want the public to know this system, the key point of the system, which is how they control money by making loans and keeping everybody in debt. Okay, next. So what are the effects on our nation? Next. Money is constantly disappearing as debt. Now, when you pay off your loan and you give the money to the bank, that money disappears. It's an accounting entry. They take it off their register. So that if they make loans, the money supply is like this. And if no more loans were made and the existing loans were being paid off day after day, the money supply would be shrinking. And as the money supply shrinks, all of us are saying, I need money. Maybe some of you don't have a job because the money supply is shrinking and your business couldn't make it, right? They couldn't get the money to do it. So you gotta go and borrow. So there's intense pressure in this system to constantly go into debt and borrow more to get the money out that everybody needs. And they built it into the system. The men who created this, there weren't, unfortunately, I have to say men because there weren't any women in this group of people that created this. And they knew exactly what they were doing. They had come from banking in Europe, and that was the system in Europe, and they brought it here. Okay, next. So loans are created, and if money is created, remember, debt is money. So the loans are created, money is created, next. As money is constantly removed, past loans are paid down, next. Everyone is competing for the remaining money. Next. So the result, consumers borrow, businesses borrow, government borrows. Next. Okay. Therefore, money is being pulled. All of our money is being pulled in two directions every day. Are we going to pay down that debt? Or are we going to spend to, you know, what we have to pay for the rent and the food. If we don't have enough money, we have to go borrow more. But if I get a paycheck, I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to pay the bank this, and then I have this left over to get my needs met. Okay? So that is in the system, and we'll live with it. Next. Consumer, because of this, because I get my paycheck and I have to pay debts as well as current living expenses, the consumer has less money. I have less money to buy what I need, my goods and services, right? So here's the cat. I did the math, we can't afford the door, right? You know, the wife turns to the husband, we can't afford it, right? Next. Everybody's disposable income is down because of all this debt, right? Next. Here's a businessman. He's trying to sell his goods and services, right? But he's in debt. So what does a businessman do? He's got to raise his prices, right? Because he's got to pay the debt out of his profits as well as pay, you know, his ongoing needs. And this is sort of fun again in the businessman says, yes, thank goodness we're not one of our creditors. And next. And because of that, next, prices go up. Okay, and this is built into the system, right? Because of all this debt on the business and on the consumer. Next. So consumers must borrow to buy. You know, you have, there's a lot of offers, you know, come in and you can have that car and we'll finance it, right? Businesses must borrow to invest. Governments must borrow to govern. Next. What are the effects on the international economy? Internationally now. Remember, this system is spread all around the world. It's not just in the United States, right? This debt money system. Next. So, it fuels the growth of multinational corporations. It's behind the growth. It's behind the drive to globalize this monetary system. Next. All nation states, wealthy and third world, doesn't matter, everybody's in debt, are exposed to debt and driven to compete for exports. Everyone wants to export to get money as a nation, right? If a firm cannot obtain sufficient sales from their national markets, they're going to go abroad, right? They got to pay their debts as well as, you know, pay their workers and their expenses and everything. Next. In an economy riddled by debt and people lacking disposable income, right? What wins? You go into a store and you go, I'm going to buy that, that's cheaper. It might not last as long, but you know, I don't have enough money. I can't buy the better product. So multinationals grow on that. They have, they buy in bulk. They do everything in bulk. So they can offer cheaper products. They're not very good, but they're cheaper. And people need to buy them because we don't have enough money left after we pay the debts and pay the rent or whatever to buy something. It's built into the system. And so the multinational corporations, they grow and grow. Next. And multinationals are also in debt. If you look at their balance sheet, they have credit lines. They have like credit cards with all the commercial banks, right? I mean, they have loans from commercial banks, but they have a little more clout with commercial banks because they take really big loans, you know, billions of dollars, $500 million, because they're big, they can do that. And they get it from the banking system, you know, they're together. But again, remember, commercial banks are unique. They're the ones that get to create our money out of debt. Next. Multinationals are the ultimate creation of the debt money system, the culmination of the unfair advantage given to big business in the debt economy. It explains globalization and why corporations have so much power around the world. Mass production, cost-cutting, employment shedding, outsourcing, bulk transport, extensive marketing, you've all heard all of these. But behind it is this money system. Next. I want to talk a little bit and then I'll hand it off. This is my belief. There's a lot of different solutions. And keep in mind, monetary systems have been changed in countries. It's not an unusual thing to change a monetary system. It was done in Europe various times in the 1800s and 1900s, right? Dennis Kucinich was in Congress for two terms, right? And he introduced a bill called the Need Act, which he presented as a jobs bill. We need jobs in this country. But what it was, to get the jobs, he proposed an alternative monetary system for the nation. And what it was, it's very simple, it's very elegant. Okay? So, first of all, our government will go and buy all the shares of the 12 Federal Reserve Banks. Right? We'll buy the shares. We don't own the shares today. They're all owned by Citibank and Goldman Sachs, all members of the Federal Reserve, all those commercial banks. All the commercial banks own the shares of the Federal Reserve banks, the 12 Federal Reserve banks. But Dennis said, okay, we're going to buy the shares, our government, and the government will really own those 12 Federal Reserve banks. That was done in Canada with the Bank of Canada, the Canadian government in 1938 bought all the shares Bank of Canada, I made a couple. So it's been done before. The banks cannot create debt money anymore. That was in the bill. No. If they make a loan, they have to have the money in an account in their bank. Money's not going to be come into existence with a loan and then disappear when the loan's turned off. No more of that. Money circulates and it stays there. Might be used for a loan, but when the loan gets paid off, the money is in the bank to be used for the thing. Okay? And the third thing is that Congress would spend debt-free government money. This is the real money. And that's the other thing we're not taught. Our American history has so many wonderful experiences where our government created money that circulated free of debt, just circulated for people to use in their lives. All of our colonies did that. England tried to stop them from issuing their debt-free colonial money, and we had the Revolutionary War. Benjamin Franklin said the real cause of the Revolutionary War was that Parliament tried to stop the American colonists and took their government debt-free money from them. There's a lot of history.
Say that again. The Parliament did what?
Parliament in like 1750s, Parliament in England said to the colonists, you cannot issue, you have to bring back your debt-free money that the colonial legislature issued so that the colonies could have an economy, have money. And because of that, Benjamin Franklin said that was the real cause of the American Revolution, because they took the government debt-free money away from the colonial government. Okay? And then the third part of it is that Congress will take this debt-free money that circulates, gives us our economy, and use it to build infrastructure, repair infrastructure, health, education. So this is one very strong, whatever alternative you find, just make sure it's not with debt money. Make sure it's with just debt-free money issued by a government and that just circulates so that people can have decent lives. Thank you.
On great trade, multinational corporations against third world countries. Adam Smith had the talk about the invisible hand back in 1776, and David Ricardo, working with comparative advantages, which means that each country specializing in one product could successfully compete with the others, and they could fit together and they would have an advantage of trading rather than trying to make everything themselves. So he had said there were four necessary parts to a successful free trade. And in 1817, he advanced his theory of comparative advantage, setting forth those four conditions, which are on the board. I can see them better on this paper than I can on the board. Do not move capital over borders from high wage to low wage country. First one. The second, balance trade between participating countries, which means that they should both mutually prosper. And the third one was trade only between countries that had full employment. And the fourth one was open competition. No monopolies or oligarchies. Today, economists believe in free trade regardless of the facts. According to free trade, both countries will benefit, but this is not true. And because they violate the four conditions of David Ricardo, capital does cross the borders from high wage to low wage countries now. Trade between the two countries is unbalanced. Each country does not have full employment. Monopolies, unbalanced trade, gaining advantage over each other. In each trade deal, one country will prosper and the other will take a loss. And in most cases, it's the wealthy countries that do so. The next slide shows how the Third World Bank, first of all, I want to state that the debt money system drives rigged trade worldwide, because everybody is under tremendous pressure to pay the debts that they owe, that they are constantly pushing for advantage, everything they do. The World Bank does not, in its charter, have the right to create money. So it sells bonds to commercial banks, private banks, and then that debt money, the banks create the money as needed to buy the bonds. And when they buy the bonds, the Third World Bank then gets that debt money, and that money is loaned to the countries, poor nations, that need the money and are eager to get a loan. On the other hand, the next slide, the International Monetary Fund does have the right to create money and lend it to the banks. And so it goes directly into circulation to poor countries when they request a special drawing right, which is defined there on the board as the IMF world currency that it creates when it makes loans to poor countries.
And they create it out of debt.
And then money is loaned into existence, so that somebody has to pay interest on it. And no bank ever creates the money to cover the interest. They only give a loan for the principal. So each country has to find a way to compete for money in circulation to pay its debt. And in the case of the international countries, all nations are in debt. They compete to repay their international debts. They must earn dollars, because the loan was usually given by a country that uses the international currency of a dollar. The poor countries compete against other poor countries, all who export similar products, which results in their glutting the market with a big surplus of products, and they are forced to drive down their prices to compete. they compete against the wealthy nations too, who strive to maximize exports and minimize imports, because they too have massive public and private debts. And then, since the 1989, the U.S. government, created by commercial banks, the country has had more imports than it has exports. Exports have risen over these 30, 40 years, but the imports have increased even faster than the exports. In other words, they run at a deficit in their international trade because they think of it's more valuable to get the money than it is to have the things that they buy. The debt money system drives rigged trade worldwide. In the next slide, poor nations are not earning enough money to repay their loans. So the private banks seize the assets, land, minerals, buildings, and food from the poor countries. The international banker here is having a good time eating up the assets. So today's situation, none of the necessary conditions for free trade to produce mutual benefits apply anywhere in today's world. In this slide, you see the price of the value of labor going down from this country to others.
Would it be possible to go into presentation mode? Because it would make the slide bigger and it's a little hard to read right now.
It's hard to read, okay.
Let's see.
Instead, all nations try to pursue an imbalance of trade where they profit the most. Multinational corps rig trade to their profit at the expense of third world nations while calling it free trade. This free trade sham has been accepted and promoted by powerful financial and legal world agencies. The World Bank, the IMF, GATT, the World Trade Organization, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, and the UN, and governments of the strongest nations support all these multinational corporations and support the wealthy countries against the poorer countries in their trade relations. They set all the standards and all the rules of international trade. As the fat man says down with the wheelbarrow, slavery is such an ugly word. We prefer the term free trade. So the next one is a vision statement for us as a group to organize a system that functions efficiently for the mutual benefit of all parties involved. This is the only, the basis of a solution to the trade problem. The objective of this is to remove the pressure of ubiquitous dread distorting all our activities. In the photograph, we see a small girl sold into slavery to pay debts, laboring under the hot sun, forming bricks in South Asia. Strategies for a fair, free trade. We need a strategy to find a solution to our debt-based financial system. Second, we need a solution to aggressive exporting from our own developed economy. Third, we should end illegitimate debts of developing nations. The developing countries, even though they've reduced their prices, the goods they give away in return for to pay for their debt. The goods we give away are value in itself that is worth more than the price they pay for them. So we believe that kind of a debt is paid for with stuff that was sold for a low price. Four, give each nation power to set priorities for and monitor its own economy using Ricardo's condition. Fifth strategy is to set a code of conduct for the multinationals, including the bankers, to counterbalance their aggressive actions. following this as recommendations based on those strategies. And they read as follows. Reform the U.S. money system by passing the NEED Act in Congress, which basically instituted the creation of money by the Treasury. This was done in the time of Abraham Lincoln, too. Abraham Lincoln issued greenbacks to carry on a successful Civil War. And they were in terrific popularity, and the banks slowly bribed Congress to get rid of them one step at a time. And I think that they were still existing back in the 60s. You could get them then. Open up the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership for Public Scrutiny and Discourse, so that everybody understands exactly what it's about. And then I made a recommendation for a debt jubilee for the developing nations. First one I wanted to read was a step above that. Have a public referendum on the Trans-Pacific Partnership at the national level, under the idea that Congress can be bribed, more enough of them to pass the bill, but I don't think they could get half the population of this country bribed successfully to pass the TPP Act. Have a debt jubilee for the developing nations. Refuse international trade agreements that contain the ISDS tribunals, which Paula described in her presentation. Modify the legal relationship between the corporation and its charter issuer to ensure the corporation does no injury to society. And this includes international organizations too, like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, and so forth. So that's my story. The final slide, please. Thank you.
We have some questions. You guys want to come up and help?
Yeah.
Okay. So should we start?
Yeah.
Can I ask
you
to keep the question?
Yeah. I had a question early on in the presentation, but I think the answer was kind of made. But let me describe. So the question was, okay. Countries like Uruguay gets sued by in this ISDS, and they've got to pay. And I was thinking, well, who's going to enforce that? Do they get mercenaries? But I think the answer is that they're in debt, so the IMF, World Bank, or somebody would hold them hostage.
Is that the
way that they enforce the penalty?
Adam, can you answer that?
The agreements that these countries are a part of are considered legally binding agreements. So if a country is, let's say a country basically defaults or refuses to pay a judgment in an ISDS case, that's sending up a big red flag to the world banking system that this is a country that is not going to be paying its debts. So in terms of the future capacity of that country basically the world banking system can tank a country that puts up a big announcement that it's not going to make good on its debts in international.
And if they continue, the mercenaries will come in.
The people will stop trading with them.
Oh.
And they won't be able to get loans and they can
get. Yeah, they will stop.
A la Greece.
I have a current example from Greece. Greece is threatening not to pay along. And I have to tell you, I can't tell you the source, but in multinational banks, they are setting up in their systems to stop money transfers into Greece. Now, Greece doesn't get any money transfers from around the world. You can imagine what happens to their economy.
One thing that's actually being built into TPP, and even some of the most pro-free trade economists, people like Jagdish Bhagwati, who wrote the book In Defense of Globalization, big fan of the WTO, he doesn't even like this. They are building into TPP, and they already built into the US-Korea Free Trade Agreement, language that would prevent capital controls. So what that would mean is that if one of the things that can be done to a country, the banks can just pull all their money from that country, and they can wipe out a country's economy by just pulling all the current. They can take all the currency out of that.
Didn't Argentina massively default on repayments of loans? And I think since then its economy has revived.
Yes, that's true. Well, so Argentina.
How did Argentina get away with it?
Big enough economy.
I don't know.
Probably they use their own money.
There was, the history.
Created debt-free money, and that was able to. Since European bankers wanted to charge them 30% interest. So they keep the run on the economy without debt money.
Did you read all of the 29 chapters?
Did I read? No, nobody.
Nobody brought out.
Nobody.
It's only on a select few.
Yes.
But when you are in charge of an organization, you pull in the top people of that organization to find out how it should be, and hopefully that they have some moral values. And based on that, if I were to send out the 29 chapters to all of Congress, the Senate and the House, number one, how many people would read it? Number two, how many people would understand it? Number three, how many people would go to the authorities again that are now under the president's control, supposedly, to inform and straighten it out? I don't think that we, as a people, at this point in time, could understand it. I think that there has to be a huge tax reform before you could even touch anything. The question was, did you read it? And the answer was no.
Okay. Nobody has.
Well, other than the
500 corporate advisors who can read it.
None of them wanted to speak here.
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. I'm from Canada and have some familiarity with a number of these ISDS suits that you cited, because Canada is the most sued nation under this mechanism, and certainly under NAFTA. And watch many cases. And I just wanted to reinforce two things and then ask a question. One point you made is that these are not, I mean, you call them judges and the arbitration panels, but they're not part of the regular court system. This is an extrajudicial system exclusively for foreign investors. So even domestic investors are not able to use this mechanism. And it's a commercial arbitration process that's secret and without appeal. And these corporations are increasingly using this to go around the regular court system that all of us have to use.
Can
and
you
the
say
example,
your question? Because other people have questions.
Yeah, the example is the $500 million suit against Canada by Eli Lilly for our generic drug practices. The Supreme Court of Canada, the highest court in our country, had ruled against them, and they're going into the this arbitration process. So I just wanted to emphasize that. And then I wanted to ask, the discussion has been about TPP, but the U.S. is also negotiating an agreement with Europe, the TTIP or TAFTA, a transatlantic free trade agreement. And Europe is the base of many of the world's largest multinational corporations. And I'm just interested in the extent to which there's similar analysis and organizing happening about the proposed deal with Europe, because we're doing a lot of organizing about the Canada-EU deal. And just by the way on that, we've had a lot of the chapters of that leaked, and we've had analysis of those chapters, so that's the way that people can understand. But anyway, that question.
I'm going to turn that to Adam in terms of what kind of organizing there might have been around.
Yeah, I mean, there is work that's going on. I mean, a lot of the, because of the fact that Fast Track will affect all trade agreements that are that go to Congress in the next 6 years, not only TPP, but also TTIP, and also TISA, potentially, the Trade and Services Agreement. It's at this point, sort of the point of the spear is all focused on stopping Fast Track. But yeah, TTIP is definitely part of the conversation, perhaps not as much because it hasn't been around as long. It's only starting to be understood, but there's been a lot of, there was just recently a leak of the regulatory cooperation chapter of TTIP, which is going to potentially create a massive new bureaucracy where countries' laws before their, basically countries will have to have their laws vetted by this bureaucracy to ensure that they are properly harmonized with the laws of other countries, and it basically in effect means that their laws are vetted as to whether they're satisfactory to corporations not having their profits cut into. There's been analysis around some of the concerns around access to medicines. There was a leak that the The EU is one of the EU's major agendas with TTIP is to get the US to lift our ban. It's been in place since 1975 in the export of crude oil. There's strong interest in importing liquid natural gas under TTIP. So there, concerns about attacks on Europe's labeling on genetically modified foods, as well as Europe's higher food safety and animal welfare standards. So it is something that is starting to be addressed. And there are groups doing good work on it. There's been the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy has done some good.
Can I interrupt for more questions? We can have more questions.
Yeah, I'm just saying that, sure.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks.
I have three brief questions.
Can you say one so other people can get
two? Okay. The most important question I have is concerning the TPP and Fast Track. Is there anyone trying to challenge the constitutionality of Fast Track to try to counter it on the basis of it not being constitutional?
I can't answer that. Do you know the answer to that? It's being challenged constitutionally?
Not in the sense of like a legal challenge.
It's been around since Nixon. So
yeah, definitely it's part of the conversation that Fast Track undermines Article 1, Section 8, Clause C, the Commerce Clause, by Congress delegating this power. It really is taking a power away that the Constitution very specifically puts in Congress's hands. So it may not, in a legal sense, be unconstitutional, but it's certainly an attack on the spirit of separation of powers, and that's one of the major arguments that's used against Fast Track.
Thank you.
I mean, this whole thing undermines the problems we're having with everything. I mean, it interferes with all the things that are ruining, are destroying our world. And one way of solving it, people are doing, is things like transition towns, where small local economy, people are using small local economies. How would that fit in? I guess we should be doing both. Trying to get the NEED Act plus this. Plus doing things on our own. But my understanding was that with the TPP, that transition towns could be sued for mm-hmm. interfering with corporate profits.
Yes.
And individuals who protest could also be sued.
Well, the government would be sued, not the individuals, but based on what they're doing.
The individuals
yes.
are doing.
And I just want to put a plug in for local, because the organization I mentioned, and it's in the handout that we'll have, is Local Futures. And the perspective is we both have to have an analysis of what's happening on a global level, but we also have to be focusing on local as a solution.
But then at some point
yes.
you might be able to sue us
yes.
for doing that, right?
That's a possibility, yes.
Right here. I do think for most people, the most persuasive argument against TPP is the ability of corporations to sue sovereign states, but you did not give an example of a successful suit against the U.S. based on other treaties. Are there any?
I think that I don't think there are. I actually is. Are there any? I think there might
there
be.
Was one against
yes, Canada, but the U.S. I mean, one of the things that Obama has said is that we've been protected, but it doesn't mean we're going to be
maybe
protected in the
have,
future.
Maybe we don't have strong enough protections for ourselves.
Or yeah. Well.
And I also wanted to know. You talked about 5 million jobs lost in manufacturing. But was there a net loss in job? Was there any job gain, or is it just a?
You know what? I would have to go back and look. That was I would have to go back and look at that statistic. But there's definitely been a net job loss because there. I don't know if it's 5 million. That was a statistic given by Lori Wallach. But there's definitely been a net job loss because companies are offshoring now. So they're moving all their business to other countries. And as I said, they're very happy that Vietnam has come in because it's going to be cheaper wages than China.
One question over there?
Yeah, you know.
There's someone else?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, right now, I really appreciate all the presentation and the questions, I'm feeling pretty despairing. And I'm wondering what keeps you all going, and maybe hearing from people in the group, what keeps us going in the face of this daunting information?
Well, I'll tell you what keeps me going.
Speak up, please.
I was a history major in college. And this, there is so much that we don't know, and I have such faith that if people were given the truth, that would make a change. We would all feel more empowered, because right now we can't figure out why is the world with all these problems. Well, we look at the systems, and we don't get blindsided by the bankers who want to take this information and, you know, leave it to their own needs. But just the plain, god-awful truth of what this system does. And listen, Dennis Kucinich is a fighter. He's a fighter. He brought that bill into Congress 2 years in a row, you know, and he's still fighting. He's still fighting for this bill.
Wait, I wanted to hear.
I think you just can't let go of the possibility, no matter how despairing things are. And the fact is, I mean, with this TPP, which I finally did hook into and stop not thinking about it, here we are with an opportunity to stop it. So I see, particularly right now, for us to be aware that we can make a difference on that. I have to be looking at both the big picture and think about what kinds of actions you take at the local level. And I was responding to the idea that we need to be going local as part of what we do. It's been much more in the CSA area in terms of local, but that kind of thing, local investing in local businesses, I mean, that's where our focus has to be, along with having the analysis at the larger level.
I just wanted to say that that I recently learned that to become an incorporated entity, I've always thought that corporations are beholden to their stockholders to make money, but I just recently found out that in the Constitution, the corporations were supposed to be restricted by the state for the purpose of public good, and for mm-hmm. doing public good, and they shouldn't, and nobody could be incorporated unless they were
passing
doing
out,
public good.
This sheet.
So that's another way to
go. Yeah. Further reading on the.
Adam, did you want? Did you have something?
And,
when he thinks
yeah.
Let. You had a question?
Yes. With regard to your proposal about a national referendum, I know when. In the fight against the free trade area of the Americas, there were non-governmental, non-binding, grassroots polling that was done in by the Zapatistas in Mexico and also by anti-FTAA organizing in Brazil. I'm wondering if that's the sort of thing you're talking about, or if you're thinking of an actual, some legal form of referendum, and I'm wondering what that would look like, given that we don't have a national referendum system in the U.S. And we have state-level issues, but we don't have a federal one. So,
well, I didn't try to work anything out. I just thought that any smaller group thought than the whole country would probably be under the thumb of financial banks. The banks don't want to give up the right to trade money. It's against the Constitution. The Constitution empowers Congress to coin the money and establish its value and maintain its value. No, nothing else. It's allowed to borrow the Constitution.
So are there any other questions that people have? If anyone wanted the PowerPoint, just put it on the sign-in that we have. We'll send it.
And let me just say also, what I'm handing out, the booklet has the history of American money in it. their true history. And there's a book on the bibliography, The Lost Science of Money, which gives you the history of money. It's an excellent book, and there's a class, you have class materials to it. There's an internet site on that list. And you can actually go and see the class materials if you wanted to teach it in the local, for your local group. Spread the information. Spread the real history of what we're up against.